Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and poisoning cases from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 48. Ah, what a wonderful week. Week two of lockdown. How are you, Nick?
I'm all right. Working from home. It's all very exciting.
Is it?
We did say we weren't going to talk about this because nothing is changing.
Oh, no, that was on Patreon where the two of us were just, it was Monday, we were drinking heavily and just going, but now it's kind of midweek. And it's like, hey, yeah, yeah,
and we're the two of us are drinking heavily.
Exactly. But we're over hump day. It's fine.
Right, okay.
So much potential.
But still, not much has changed.
No, not much has changed. The death rates are rising. We're confined to our house forever. But, you know, it's probably fine as long as we have alcohol.
Exactly. That's all one needs in these situations.
Exactly. Any poisonings this week?
No, don't believe so.
No, not in your general area.
Not in my general area of where I can reach from my desk. So I'm being fancy calling it a desk. In fact, my dining table.
No poisonings in the house and no hints of murders around you or anything or next door that you've had to investigate?
Well, not in the immediate vicinity.
Oh, good. I mean,
there is no one living in the house next door. Or perhaps they are dead and just very, very quiet.
Oh, okay. That's fine. They haven't found the body.
So it could well be that many murders have taken place and quite successfully.
and you've just been sitting, swilling your brown and going, I hear nothing at all.
Exactly. All is quiet. All is well with the world.
I'm sure there's two sides to this. Speaking of poisonings and people dying, some people we really hope don't die are our fabulous Patreon subscribers.
Oh, that was weird.
I'm just trying new segues into that every week now.
Because that was a delight, that one. We hope you don't die.
Exactly, we hope you don't die. And fuck off as well. You sitting there judging. I don't hear you making up witty repartee on the dime.
I don't hear this either.
This kitten's got claws. That was quite a good retort. Very witty. That was really
very good. Very good.
So, well, shall we thank our Patreon subscribers?
We should indeed. So thank you so much to the darling Maggie Reed.
Thank you to Janelle Montez.
And to Sarah Nugent. Thank you very much. You're all entirely delightful.
Beautiful, sexy, sexy people. Sexy names this week. Those are all exotic, fun names. I like them.
Yes, Maggie.
Maggie.
Sarah. They're strange and exotic names. Okay.
Well, the surnames are quite good. You've got Nugent.
Yes,
Excuse me for trying to bring a bit of mystery to their lives. It's lockdown. Let's just give them 2 seconds of happiness. Thank you so much for subscribing and enduring this abuse, apparently, that we told out over the airways.
Absolutely. Probably not subscribing for long.
No. Well, Nick, are you ready to drink cocktails and talk about poison?
I certainly am. I've already had 2 glasses of wine, so that's probably where a lot of this is coming from.
And I sense that has loosened your tongue. Well, we could, and we really could, Nick, drink poison and talk about cocktails. You don't know what I put in your wine.
This is true.
Yeah.
Well, unless you've snuck into my house and I haven't noticed in the past 6 weeks, then I think I'm okay.
You know I could do it.
This is true, you could.
I could sneak into your house, I wouldn't do it quietly.
That is also true.
I could actually do it if I wanted to, but I'd fall over something and just go, oh, fuck, shit, shh, shh, I'm not here.
But then you would go through the cupboards and make yourself a drink as well while you're here.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Oh, because you've got all the good stuff. You've got the entire poisonous cabinet. I'm stuck with my pedestrian martinis and mezcals. Yeah, that's what would happen. So I think we've concluded that we're going to go with the first one.
Please so. Do the first one.
We're going to drink cocktails and talk about poison and try to regain what is left of our tiny, tiny minds. I think it's the lockdown mood. I think everyone has just lost their minds. It's fine. You're not allowed wine to start your episodes anymore. You're allowed a Negroni. When you have white wine, the cat claws come out. But that's what the people pay for, honestly.
Well, exactly. You are paid to deal with this abuse.
Well, actually, most of the people listening to this one, they're not paying. It's free. It's free abuse.
If you want Sinead to get more abuse, then join our Patreon.
Oh, that's dark.
Where over there is just vile and vitriol. I'm very nasty.
Patreon's more like kind of after hours crowded around that last whiskey at a darkened bar, just bitterly muttering about poisonings and the tales that we've heard. That's why Patreon's such a great place. And the few who are initiated, they know it well. Well, it's your story, Nick.
Yes.
Hooray, hooray, hooray. But as we've established, indeed, we can't possibly, can't hear a story without a cocktail in hand.
Madness would be such a thing.
Insane. Far worse than anything we've said today. As it's your story this week, you got to choose the secret ingredient that will flavour the cocktail and is inspired by the tale that we tell. And this week's secret ingredient is...
is wine.
Wine?
A lovely white wine.
A white wine. We have not done a white wine. We've done red. We've done sparkling.
And we've done fizz, but no white.
Yes. Now, we love a martini, which is vermouth-based, which is a wine-based spirit. Is a vermouth a wine-based spirit,
yes,
isn't it?
It is, yes. It's like a fortified thing, yeah.
But having just white wine in a cocktail, ooh, that could be dangerous. Yet delicious. I'm intrigued.
Well, hopefully it is going to be delicious. We shall find out soon enough.
Indeed. So with white wine as your inspiration, what have you come up with?
I have made a very exciting white wine spritzer.
No, you fucking haven't.
No, I haven't.
Oh,
I
God.
I lied.
I swear to God, I believed you. I was like, I don't want that. What? Oh, thank the good Lord.
No, I lied. I'm so funny. I have made a left bank martini.
Ooh. Oh, I like. So,
yes.
Thinking left bank from Paris?
I don't know in the slightest, to be honest.
Isn't the left bank the kind of artistic or the one of the beautiful areas of Paris?
Well, potentially it was developed in London in the 2000s, but I do not know what the inspiration behind the name. Perhaps on the left bank of the Thames.
Oh, that's a good point. Or it could be that someone left a bank and needed a drink.
There is that too. Yes.
Or they could be meaning the left bank of the Thames.
Or perhaps they left Bank tube station and turned left.
They did. They just walked around in a circle for ages around Bank.
So, who knows?
Depends which direction you're facing.
Well, exactly, yes.
Exactly. Okay, a left bank martini. I like this idea. I like the sound of it. And I'm intrigued. Nick has delivered me the special ingredients for this week's cocktail. So it's time for us to go into our isolation kitchens and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
I'll see you in a sec.
And we're back.
Hello.
So a left bank, Nick. Looks sophisticated.
Looks very fancy.
I did look up left bank in the interim while mixing up the cocktail. And I was right. It is the left bank of Paris was where all the artists were. All the artists and the thinkers and the great philosophers in, you know, I suppose the Belle Epoque. And then a little later on, I'm not being a historian on this one. But yes, the left bank. So an era of beauty and of art and of free thinking
Quite.
And of creativity. And now we have a cocktail to go with it.
Well, indeed.
So it looks very beautiful.
It does indeed. Looks very sophisticated. Not at all brown.
Yes, because we've had a bad run, haven't we?
Have we had a bad run?
A mediocre run, which is the worst kind of run.
A questionable run, haven't we, really? There's been a few relatively uninspiring drinks.
Yeah, they were only okay. So we got high hopes for this one. Well, I'd say talk us through it, but now you refuse to do that until I've tasted
it. Nope, none of that.
Let us have a taste and see what we think. So,
Merry Christmas.
Ooh.
I find that very pleasant.
That is incredibly pleasant.
That is very nice Ooh. Indeed.
Oh, it's elegant. Oh, it's elegant. It's sophisticated. It's, I don't know. I don't know what it wants me to do.
It's nice.
That's lovely.
It's very good.
So all I can get is that definitely a martini flavour, but without any of the harshness that you sometimes will get with a gin martini, I guess. And there's a little perfume to it. So, I'm intrigued, Nick. Talk us through it.
Well, we have the basis of a martini. So we have gin and vermouth.
Okay.
We also have some white wine.
White wine.
As established. But then we also have elderflower.
Really?
Which is your perfumey aroma that you're getting is, in fact, elderflower.
Yeah, because I don't really hate elderflower.
Yes, I know you're not a fan of elderflower, so I'm quite glad that you don't dislike this one. Mm. I mean, there's half an ounce of elderflower.
It's quite a bit, actually.
So I would be tempted to knock it down slightly, because I find it quite noticeable. And not unpleasant, knock it down a wee little bit, but otherwise it's a really nice drink.
I think that's lovely. I mean, honestly, I am not a massive fan of the elderflower. I don't mind it, but I find it everyone puts elderflower in everything. I think there was a period maybe about 2 years ago where elderflower
was everywhere.
Bloody everywhere. Elderflower gin, elderflower syrup in wine and champagne, elderflower in your food. And it's too perfumed. It's a really strong flavour and it was overused, much like lavender. And so, yeah, normally I hate it. But that, honestly, I mean, you said knock it down a bit. Mm. I just got a hint of the perfume, but I'm not getting, elderflower. It's lovely.
Excellent.
It's smooth.
Well, again, for me, this one, as I always do, I've had to buy a massive bottle of elderflower liqueur. So expect it in many future cocktails. Because they're a surprisingly large amount that do require a drop of elderflower. And now I'm quite glad to have this in the cupboard now.
Well, this is good because elderflower has not come up as an ingredient yet, and elderflower is technically poisonous.
Indeed. So
elder is very witchy. It's associated with witches, and it can conversely be good luck or bad luck, depending on which side you fall.
Depending on what day it is of the week it is.
Yeah, I personally find elder trees and elderflower and elder bushes quite horrible, so I remove them from my gardens before the berries can have a chance.
Well, luckily, there's no actual elder tree in this cocktail.
Oh, thank God.
Nor is there one in the story. So we are safe on all fronts.
Hooray. So with our left bank martinis firmly in hand, you're going to tell us the story, Nick?
I am. I'm so very glad you picked up on the left bank of the Seine, because we are, in fact, going to Paris.
Yay!
For our story.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So it's a hot summer night in August 1933.
Ooh, I like it. I like it. Hot jazz out there on the left bank.
Hot summer's night. Monsieur and Madame Mayu are sound asleep in bed in their apartment. Number 9, Rue de Madagascar. Mm? I'm not going to attempt to pronounce French things in a French way because it will go very, very bad. Especially after some wine, it'll get very insulting and turn into an episode of Hello, Hello. So it's probably best we don't do that.
That's just in a Patreon episode that we'll follow up with.
The nearby church bells have just chimed midnight when suddenly a scream rips through the building.
Oh my God.
A few seconds later, there is a mad pounding at the front door and the voice of a young woman cries out, Monsieur Mayo, wake up, come quick.
Oh God.
Now, Monsieur Mayo and his wife groggily wake up and stumble out of bed, and by the time they have put their night jackets on and nightgown and reach the apartment door, the whole house is awake. It's a big six-story townhouse, lots of apartments, lots of families.
So like a tenement building.
Like a tenement building. It's still quite nice, sort of middle-class sort of place. Lots of people living in this place. So there's lots of people who have come out of their apartments into the stairwell. What is this racket going on? The concierge of the building, he is rushing up the stairs, demanding to know what all this commotion is about.
Oh, goodness. I love the scene setting here, actually.
I know,
it's midnight
good.
In the streets of Paris. I love it.
When Monsieur Mayo opens his front door, a young woman falls into his arms in sobs. She is a tall, dark-haired and beautiful.
Is it Esmeralda?
Not.
The hunchback has not struck again.
Wearing a sparkling evening gown underneath a man's overcoat. Monsieur Mayo instantly recognises this woman as Violette Nozère, the daughter of the couple who live in the apartment opposite. He tries to calm her down and find out what is going on. "It's Mama and Papa," she cries. "They're dead. The place is full of gas."
Oh, Christ.
And as soon as she has spoken these words, the sweet smell of that sweet, sickly smell of gas starts seeping out, and it's quite obvious. Now, the concierge, he gets a whiff of this and he heads straight downstairs to turn the gas off in the basement. And when he returns, he opens the front door to the Nozère's apartment and he is hit by a wall of gas. Hey. All the gawkers and onlookers from the stairwell, they rush back to their own apartments and slam doors and start stuffing coats in the gaps to stop the gas coming into their own homes. The concierge, though, he's a brave chap. He clamps a handkerchief to his face.
Yes, that all-encompassing good bit of armour.
Absolutely.
There, a
handkerchief will sort you out against anything. And he rushes into the apartment. He finds the gas on at the kitchen stove. Mm-hmm. No flame, obviously, the gas just left on. He quickly turns it all off and throws open all the windows in the apartment to get some air and try and clear the gas out. In the hallway, Violet is telling Monsieur and Madame Mayo and a few of the other nosy neighbours who have stuck around.
There's 10 people.
Absolutely. They're sort of peering. Exactly.
Oh, they're dead, are they? Okay, please, let us
know. What the hell? What's going on? What's going on?
Well, that's very dangerous as well, actually. They're just hanging around in a gas-filled apartment.
Yeah, they're French. They've got their their martini.
They smoke liberally. It's fine. Their lungs are shot to shit. It's fine.
Gas leak? I'll have a cigarette. It's fine.
Exactly. We'll burn the shit away.
She has just come home after staying with a friends for a few days, and as soon as she's opened the door, she has smelt the gas. She says she has called out to her parents, but there is no answer. She says she's run through the apartment and found her father's body lifeless on the bedroom floor, her mother laying in the bed next to him. And this is exactly what the concierge has found. Jean-Baptiste Nozère lying on the floor in his nightshirt beside the bed, one hand clutching the leg of the bed as if he had been trying to stand but was too weak and wasn't able to hoist himself up. His wife, thin and frail, lay in her nightgown on the bed, her hands neatly folded by her side as if she was expecting death.
Ooh, intrigue.
Intrigue.
What the fuck?
During all this commotion, thankfully, someone has had the thought to call the authorities. You would hope, and thankfully someone has, and soon the apartment is full of activity. There's a uniformed gendarme taking notes of Violet's account in the hallway, finding out what's happened, getting her statement. I mean, she says she's not been staying home much of late, and she knows of no reason that her parents would do such a thing. She is instantly leapt to the assumption of suicide.
Yeah, because it seems like she's laying on the bed, that the husband and her have had a conversation. He's gone and lit the gas, come back and tried to hoist himself onto the bed and didn't quite make it. Sold it, cracked it, there we are.
Sorted. Yeah. So that she knows of no reasons for her parents' apparent suicide. Possibly money worry, she thinks, maybe, but who knows. Violet is led away by a concerned neighbour down the stories of the building. She doesn't want this young woman to see the bodies of her parents stretched out of the apartment.
You can imagine in an apartment building, everyone would be getting in on it, wouldn't they? Be like, oh no,
absolutely.
Come to my house and have tea, tell me everything you know.
So the body of Monsieur Nozère is covered and taken out of a stretcher. Now medics are just about to draw a sheet over the face of Madame Nozère when one of them shouts, "Quick, get me a mirror."
No.
A gendarme quickly grabs one from the nightstand and holds it under her nose. And to everyone's amazement, there is the faintest sign of breath.
She's alive.
On this mirror. And a cry went out throughout the building. She's still alive.
Ooh, I'm fully like hand to mouth at the moment. I was not expecting that. Oh my God, what a twist.
She is rushed to the nearby hospital of Saint Anton. It is touch and go. The doctors work throughout the night. She is in a coma. She's in critical condition, but she is hanging in there.
Good for her. You hang in there, you.
You hang in there. Now, while the doctors are working to save Madame Nozère at the hospital, Assistant Police Chief Gaston Mozère arrives at the flat to start his investigation. What is going on? At first, the case seems straightforward-ish to him.
Is he wearing like a mat and he's walking around with his hands in his pocket with his trilby on, like, and just smoking? Ah,
Exactly. Yeah. He's got a Galois pipe as well at the same time.
At the same time. He's smoking a pipe and a cigar and a cigarette. Ah, we're the old ones. They always try to get past me. I swear to God. Ah, mon Dieu.
He reasons that for some reason, the couple have chosen to turn the gas on and lie down to die.
So sad.
They think then perhaps Monsieur Nozière has had a change of heart at the last minute, and he has tried to get back to the kitchen to turn off the gas, but he is overcome by the fumes, too weak, and he has fallen to the bedroom floor. Now, none of the neighbours can offer any insight as to why the Nozières would have wanted to commit suicide, despite Violet's mentioning that her parents have been in financial troubles, and no one else was aware of any money worries. Neither were there any health issues that anyone was aware of. The police actually found bank books in the house that show that the Nozères were quite comfortably off. Monsieur Nozère had a good salary, he was a train engineer, and they lived very modestly. The only possible thing that a number of neighbours could point to was the stress and upset that had been caused by the scandalous goings-on of their wayward daughter.
No. No!
Who had left home a few months before, declaring that she was going to live life on her own. She was gone. She's 18 years old, but she's unmarried.
And the moment you mentioned her turning up in a sparkly dress under a man's coat at midnight, I was like, this is a woman who knows the ways of the night.
Indeed.
Who is not shy of a party and is coming home to her dear, good, honest parents. And if she's wandering around kind of going, I think they have many problems. I don't know. I'm just doing her voice like that. You know, translate it from French and it would sound like that.
Yeah. So next time, do that in French.
Oh, je ne sais pas. Le man, le man, le ma père. Le argent, c'est très difficile. Seamless, mate. Seamless.
It's perfect. I mean, I thought I was in France. But she is nowhere to be found. The chief wants to question her. She was last seen being taken down the stairs moments before that they found that her mother was still alive. Now, the gendarme had assumed that she would be staying with neighbours and that she would be easy to find. Why would she go and hide somewhere?
So he
had not taken any name or address or anything about where she would be staying, and none of the other residents knew where she had gone to. But they were quite sure that none of her friends were local to this very respectable and middle-class area that they lived. The chief thought, oh, well, she'll turn up in the morning. I mean, he was more concerned that she didn't know that her mother was alive.
Yeah. What did she do? Did she just go in and just go, they're dead, and then just walk out?
Well, I mean, there was gas, so she couldn't, the whole place was full of gas, so she couldn't stay there and pretend to examine.
No.
So she smelt the gas, saw her parents, ran out to get help.
But she said they were dead. She said they were dead, and she didn't say
she was
help
convinced
me.
They were dead, banging on the door. She wanted help. She was going, they're dead.
Yeah.
I can't imagine in a gas-filled apartment she had stopped to check for a pulse.
True that. I mean, I'm leaning on the side of if there's a gas-filled apartment and you see your parents passed out, you'll be going, help me, they might still be alive. Go save them, rather than, they're dead, let's move on. Maybe she was just knocking on the door to go, by the way, my parents are dead, let's organise the funeral.
But there was one thing in the apartment building that was puzzling Chief Mozère. The kitchen table still had the remains of an evening meal, complete with half-drunk glasses of wine.
Lovely, white lovely wine, you say?
Yes, lovely, lovely glasses. Half-drunk.
Absolutely
madness.
They had to have killed themselves if they just went, we can't finish this wine. It's time to end our lives.
But, puzzling thing, the table was set for three.
What the fuck? No. What?
Who was this third diner? I mean, it was possible that the Nazaires had made their suicide pact over dinner, didn't clear the table, and got straight to it. But who was this third person?
Who was the third party?
We don't know.
Did they bring the wine? Was it that bad now, a dinner party? Was it just one of those dinner parties where someone came round and went, sure, the fish was fine, it was all right. And then they left, well, we have to kill ourselves now, we can never face society again.
Now, no one had seen anyone else in the building on that day. The concierge confirmed he had been sitting out front until about 10 in the evening, and he was sure that the only people who he had seen were other residents of the building. There were no guests or anything like that. Violet hadn't been there herself before the 12 o'clock discovery. So there was no... Who was this third person?
Yeah.
No one knew.
I love a mystery setting, place setting. I love the idea of like, there was a third party there at was a dinner.
Third, yes.
Oh my God, I love the story so much. And they had white wine with dinner. Was it good wine, at least?
I do not know the exact variety of the wine.
God damn it.
Also, Monsieur Mayer, the neighbour, I mean, he has said they did not hear a peep from the Nazaire's apartment all evening. I mean, certainly not perhaps the joyful, chattering noises you would expect for having a merry dinner with friends. No one, it was as silent as anything. I mean, in fact, no one had seen the Nazaires at all that day. But this would all be cleared up. Shortly, Violet would be back at any moment. And if Madame Nazaire pulled through and woke up, she would be able to tell everyone exactly what is going on. But by the morning, everything had been thrown into chaos and turmoil. A report has arrived from the doctors at St. Anton Hospital. Madame Nazaire is still in critical condition, but she was not, as everyone had suspected, suffering from the effects of inhaling gas.
What?
Instead, they had discovered that Madame Nazaire had taken or been given a huge dose of Vernoral.
No!
Which was a local brand name for the sleeping drug Barbitual.
Yes! Oh my God! Mind blown! Oh, she was and she was lying peacefully. She'd take it. Oh, my God.
Turns out the amount of gas she had inhaled was negligible. She had already been drugged by the time the gas had started to flow and she was inhaling it.
Oh, no,
she was lying in bed, out of it, as the gas started to flow.
Oh, there's evil.
On this discovery, they immediately order an autopsy of Monsieur Nazaire. Yay. And sure enough, they discover that he has also died from a massive dose of Vernoral.
Shit.
Now, this apparent suicide pact is looking more and more suspicious and more sinister as it goes.
Yeah, I guess... I'm sure it's not going to go this way, but a very macabre version of it would be is you take the drugs and then turn on the gas and then sit in the bath with the toaster to make sure it's going to happen. I'm basing this mostly on the film Delicatessen, which I think I have referenced in this podcast before. I'm thinking that wasn't the case. They weren't just being extra safe.
The police are taking a more suspicious view of things.
Fully have an eyebrow raised.
They have at least one eyebrow raised.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly two, maybe even a third. It's getting quite curious at the police station.
It's getting quite weird as well.
Now, with this new development, the case is handed over to the Sûreté Nationale, the national French police.
Ooh, that is big.
Who have a lot more experience with these really serious crimes than the local gendarme. The investigation is taken over by Inspector Marcel Guillaume.
Ooh, good name.
He is famous across France.
Okay.
This detective. And he is actually the inspiration for Inspector Magret.
He isn't, really?
Yes, he knew the author. The author of Inspector Magret, I don't know his name, was a friend of the inspector, and the inspector was the inspiration for the fictional detective.
Oh, go watch that afterwards. You'll enjoy it.
Now, the inspector urgently wants to talk to Violet. She has still not turned up. With the new theory of murder, the forensic technicians are sent to the apartment and they go through everything in minute detail. In two of the wine glasses on the table, they find traces of Vernoral, this sleeping drug. Fingerprints on the third glass are too smudged to get a proper print and for an identification.
Really? Not heard of that before. But it's convenient, isn't it?
Oh, very convenient. In a waste paper basket, they find a note from a Dr. Duron instructing Monsieur and Madame Nizet to take the powders enclosed.
What?
So the note they find from the doctor.
Wait a minute. So the doctors prescribed them the barbiturates.
Some powders. It would have been obviously a little parcel that had this prescription enclosing it.
Take these powders. For they are my blood.
In a dresser drawer, they find a stack of passionate love letters addressed to Violet.
What?
They are all from a chap called Louis Pierre.
Could he have more of a French name? Sorry.
Absolutely.
Louis Pierre Le Fleur de Fleur. Sorry, any French listeners.
The most recent ones speak of marriage, their devotion to each other, and are very, very passionate.
Marriage to her, not just speak of marriage. Just
between Violet and
Louis. He didn't just write,
Pierre.
I love you, and here is a dictionary definition of marriage.
I love you, and I'm getting married to Doris. No.
I thought you should know.
Doris, that classic French name.
Maybe that's why she was so enraged. Because I'm still pinning it on her at this point, but I don't know. My mind is blown. Everyone is a suspect right now. The doctor was sending the powders. Someone was writing her love letters. The dictionary, right? Dr. Johnson was writing her love letters. Oh, God, it's a roller coaster. Carry on.
Oh, thank you. First, they go to see Dr. Duron. He is a respectable, well-known doctor. And when he is interviewed, he claims the note to be a complete forgery. Nothing like my signature, nothing like my handwriting.
Nice.
I have never met the Nazares before. But I have been treating their daughter for anemia.
No. Oh, the bitch.
Next, they take a trip to visit Louis Pierre. He has a small studio apartment in the Latin Quarter.
Which is the left bank.
Yeah, absolutely. The concierge tells the inspector that Pierre is a law student, but he is well in with the big art crowd. He has a reputation as a wild party animal, as we would say, probably didn't use that word, not that phrase, but he is on the scene, he's there partying with the best of them.
One of the beautiful people, I suppose.
He also has a very flashy, beautiful new girlfriend who has been staying quite a lot recently.
Naughty.
Which we get from the letters. Now, the inspector and his task force, his subordinates, visit all the nearby cafes and restaurants and clubs and things and question anyone they come across. And they find a young woman named Madeleine
Debise.
Who said she is Violet's closest friend.
Ooh.
She doesn't know where Violet is now, but on last she is able to provide her with an alibi for that Monday evening. The night that her parents have died. Violet and I were at a party, she says, with some student friends last night. We had dinner at about 5 in a little brasserie up the street, and then we went dancing at the Bal Tabrin. We were tired and we left the party early, about 11 o'clock, and Violet said she thought she'd go home to her parents for the night.
Mm-hmm.
That all tied in very nicely with her then arriving around midnight at her parents' apartment and discovering that. But she has got an absolute alibi now for her movements throughout that evening.
It sounds completely plausible. Also, can I just say, God, that sounds nice right about now. Just go out, just a little dinner, then a little dancing, a few drinks, then go and see your parents, then just go to your family. Oh, put on a dress and go and dance. Sorry, I might be getting more emotionally involved in this story than I normally would. I'm slightly leaning towards whatever she did was fine. She got to see people. I don't care.
Madeleine is able to fill them in on Violet's movements early that day as well. She had lunch with a young artist in a cafe on the Boulevard Haussmann and then spent most of the afternoon riding round the cafes of the quarter with two Egyptian students in their new car.
Oh, she can just fuck off, quite frankly, right now. She's showing off.
She is living quite the life.
She's not, though.
This sort of it girl.
She's just saying that to all of the police, like we do on Instagram. Oh my God, living my best life. She was at home in her shitty pajamas eating just mayonnaise with a spoon.
That's you.
That's yeah. I will put my prejudices aside for a minute.
Back in the Nazaire's apartment block, Inspector Guillaume and his colleagues are finding a slightly different view of young Violet. The residents there can't provide any clue to where she is, but they have plenty to say about her past. Her parents just couldn't seem to control her, one woman says. She was always in trouble at school. Since the age of 12 or 13, she's been running around with one man or another. She simply became attractive to men too soon, and it turned her head, they said. They tell that Violet has left home several times in the past, but has always come back. She was constantly arguing with her long-suffering parents, asserting her right to live on her own, to do her own thing, but then constantly returning to them for handouts and for money.
Teenagers.
Yeah, pretty much.
I can live my own life. Please, can I have money to do it?
Exactly. Monsieur Mayo provides, the neighbour provides, a slightly more sinister interpretation. This wasn't the first time that there had been suspicious happenings in the Nazaire apartment. Only 2 months previously, the Nazaires had again almost been overcome by a leaking gas jet.
What?
Another time, their bedroom window curtains mysteriously caught fire. And three or four times, they were racked with terrible, terrible pains after eating. And had called Monsieur Mayo to send for a doctor.
What?
None of these things were explained. They were just things that had happened.
Sweet Jesus.
Investigations show that Monsieur Nazaire had about 180,000 francs in the bank. Ooh. It's a considerable sum of money, which would have first go to his wife and then to Violet in the event of his death. Now, in the middle of the investigation, Louis-Pierre comes back to Paris. He finds out from the concierge of his building that the police have been looking for him, and he voluntarily goes and says, "Right, I'm Louis-Pierre. I hear you're looking for me. What's up?" He says that he and Violet have been friends for about a year, but when her parents found his letters to her, they forbade her from seeing him at all.
Okay.
When this happened, he then promised marriage to Violet, and she promptly leaves home and moves into his studio. So obviously, I mean, he's a law student. He's from a fairly well-to-do family. So what objections the Nazaires have against this match, I don't know, but they seem to be quite against it. But perhaps he has a bit of a reputation, a bit of a playboy, a bit of a man about town type thing.
He does sound like he's a law student from a very rich family,
yep,
who is living up in Paris and living in a studio and shagging all the birds and drinking all the wine, which is absolutely fine, but
maybe not an appropriate husband for their darling daughter.
Not an appropriate husband. Yeah,
perhaps this has caused her to leave home for the final time and move into the studio. Now, when pressed about how Violet was supposed to be supporting her party lifestyle, Pierre admits that Violet has been getting money from other men.
Oh, what? Oh, come on. Oh, Violet.
Yes, indeed. So there is no definitive thing that says, yes, she's a prostitute or anything like that. Or is she just providing I'll go to dinner with you type service thing, or if it's
escort
type thing, but she is getting money from older gentlemen, which is helping fund her lifestyle. It's also actually helping fund his lifestyle as well, and she is supporting him.
Yeah, that's quite shitty. Sex workers work, no judgment on that. Whatever happens, happens. If you want to support yourself, you do what you want. But if it's a little bit of selling her out that she's shagging other men and it's supporting him,
it would seem
this all seems quite horrible.
His parents look upon his current lifestyle very unfavourably, and they have reduced his sort of allowance considerably. So to top it up, Violet is supporting them both.
What the fuck is he doing? Why isn't he out having sex with other men or women?
Perhaps he wasn't, just not getting paid for it, I don't know.
He was just doing it for pleasure, yeah, but you need to be paid for it. Oh, for God's sake.
But when he is questioned about where is she now, he claims he does not know. I haven't seen her since last week, he says. I don't know where she is. But, he said, she mentioned a funny thing in a letter the other day. She said she had inherited some money. She was going to buy a car and come and get me. The hunt for Violet Nazaire becomes the main focus for the National Police. But when they put the timeline together, it just doesn't fit. They have a dozen witnesses saying that Violet is partying in the Latin Quarter all afternoon, all evening on that Monday. She couldn't possibly have been in the apartment, been that third diner at the table, and then to drug and gas her parents as well. It just doesn't work. She's got a perfect alibi. The last time she was seen with her parents was, in fact, the Sunday, when she had visited for lunch. And then after that, she is seen drinking and dancing in Montmartre until dawn on the Sunday. It looks like she has to be in the clear. I mean, nevertheless, the inspector still wants to talk to her, if only to let her know that her mother is still alive and there is a chance she's going to get better. But the next morning comes news from the hospital that breaks the case wide open. Madame Nazaire has woken from her coma. She is conscious, she is talking, and the first words she utters when she is able to talk and she's learned that her husband is dead is to point the finger straight at Violet. Their own daughter has poisoned them. She had administered the Ronal under the guise of powders prescribed by Dr. Duron for headaches. Madame Nazaire is also able to sort out the riddle of the timing. The poisoning, in fact, had taken place on the Sunday afternoon when Violet had come by for lunch, and not on the Monday, as everyone had assumed. As they had been eating their Sunday lunch together, both her and her husband had been overcome with nausea. And on the insistence of their daughter, they went straight to bed. They didn't even finish their meal. You need to go and lie down. You need to go and rest. Now, while Violet supposedly goes and rings the doctor for advice, minutes later she returns with two glasses, saying the doctor has said to take bicarbonate to settle your stomachs. She gives them these two glasses with a white powder floating in the water.
Oh, that's cold.
The elderly couple are actually quite taken aback by the new sort of slightly caring attitude of their daughter, who has only ever been there when she wants something. Now she's there looking after them, so they gladly take and drink back this bicarbonate given to them by their daughter. Within moments, they are out cold, and it all falls into place. She has drugged her parents Sunday afternoon and left them to die. Now, while her parents lay dying, she goes out partying in Montmartre with the money she has taken from the apartment. Then, after establishing her alibi for Monday night, she comes back at midnight, turns on the gas, and to make it look like it has just happened, and rushes out into the hall screaming.
Oh, clever girl.
That girl has the cunning of a devil, says Inspector Guillaume. But they still don't know where she is. She's still missing.
Yeah, where is she? That is clever. Do it on the... That is more Agatha Christie than we've seen.
Oh, absolutely.
Do it on the sun. Everyone thinks the dinner was on the Monday.
Yep.
And they'd had something and they'd gone to bed. But Sunday it happened and she came back and turned on the gas. Oh, what a bitch.
But they still don't know where she is. Her picture is now in every paper in the country. Her name is on every radio station. There is a nationwide hunt for this cold-blooded woman who would kill her own parents. When Madame Nazaire is allowed back into her apartment, she finds that 3,000 francs that had been in the dresser ready to go to the bank was missing. Also, 1,000 francs that she had hidden amongst her dresses is also gone. It is now clear to the police how Violet has enjoyed such an extravagant few days.
Oh, yeah.
On August 29th, about 10 days after the murder, Count Henri Dubec,
nice,
a young engineer, reports to the police he has made a date for that night with a lovely young woman who calls herself Christiane Daffay. He is sure that this is the elusive Violet. Her picture has been in all the papers and he has recognised her. When the woman turns up for their date, a squad of detectives is hiding behind a shrub and they pounce.
They're not behind a shrub, are they?
They're not there, but they're there. They're concealed nearby. She
they
rocks
just
up.
Wandered up holding a small sprig of holly.
Yes.
And just shuffling into the cafe. It's her. It's her. Pounce.
And they make their arrest. Ooh. Now, the public feeling is so strong about this that a mob tries to storm the Petit Roquette prison where Violet is being held. And she has to be removed under heavy guard for her own protection.
Bloody hell.
Because the sentiment is so high. Now, under questioning by the inspector, Violet freely admits to poisoning her parents.
Really?
Yes. She claims that she is only meant to kill her father and gave less of the poison to her mother, which perhaps bears out because her mother did survive. But she claims that her father had assaulted her. and that in fact she was pregnant by him. Now, an examination disproved this pregnancy entirely. She was not pregnant at all. And the inspector was able to prove that any assault did not take place. Well, not at the time and place that she said it did. He was able to disprove that. But this is the reason that she came up with, to try and cast her father in such a terrible light. Actually, in fact, her own mother takes out a civil lawsuit against her for slander of the dead, because she has made these claims against her father.
You can't actually do that, but still, good luck.
She tried.
It sounds like she's a complete and utter fantasist, and she's been making lies up left, right and centre. And this seems like a desperate attempt to go, I'm pregnant, the old pregnant thing. And then daddy did it, and you can't blame me because daddy's a bastard. And obviously if it's disproven, she's just desperate.
Oh, indeed. If you look at probably the photograph of her we will use for this Patreon episode, is her actually photographed the night she was arrested wearing clothes that she had bought with the money from her parents' apartments. And I mean, she looks incredibly chic. She's there, she's got a long black coat on with a big black fur collar. She's got a beret going on. Very French, very sophisticated. All freshly bought with the money she had stolen from the apartment.
So it doesn't seem like the actions of someone who has just been physically assaulted.
Indeed not. No, absolutely not. Jesus. More than a year passes before the police investigation is complete and they are happy to go to trial. Now, during this time, she has been annihilated in the press, absolutely torn to pieces. She is now seen as this scarlet woman, this middle class prostitute, this habitual liar. She is torn to pieces, torn to shreds in the press. She is never going to receive a fair trial.
Fair enough.
But it takes the jury minutes to decide that Violette Nazaire is guilty. The judge sentences her to die on the guillotine.
She's not. Is she the last?
No.
No, she's not the last. Oh.
No woman had been executed in France since 1887. And it had become standard practice that if they were given the death penalty, it would be automatically commuted to life. And there was actually a slightly interesting side note, actually, as to why no women had been sentenced to death since 1887. In 1887, there was quite a famous case where Jeanine Thomas and her husband had been convicted for killing Jeanne's mother and burning her body in a fireplace. Now, they were sentenced to be beheaded, but Jeanine collapsed in hysterics on the scaffold and made such a scene and such a furore that everyone watching was just like, we don't need to see this anymore, fuck that. So then from then on, no women were executed because of this potential spectacle that they would cause when they were going to their execution. I mean, it didn't matter,
because that was just a thing that women did. Women will go mental.
They'll just go mad.
Men
will be fine. They'll do it with dignity. Women, they'll just go nuts. They'll cry. They'll scream. They'll shout. People don't want to see that. I mean, you could have done it behind closed doors if you had to do it. Didn't have to be in front of every 50,000 people.
Public executions. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's why she wasn't executed. But she only serves 12 years in prison. In 1945, she is freed. Now, 1945, now I suppose French authorities have a bit more to worry about after the Second World War.
Well, it's ended, they're fine.
I think they had a bit to contend with after that.
Yeah, well, before that and afterward, it wasn't plain sailing.
No, indeed not. She goes and she lives for a further 20 years. She eventually marries. She has 5 children of her own. And in fact, by the end of her life, she is a devout Christian. She is a respectable woman. She is beloved by her family and her neighbours and people in the town. Possibly most surprising is that her mother actually ends up living with Violet and her new husband.
What?
And outlives her notorious daughter by several years.
Was that what she wanted to do the whole time? Was just watch her daughter die. Going, I outlived you, you bitch.
But maybe so. I don't know. But obviously, some sort of reconciliation was had there. So that is the story of Violet Nazaire, who killed her father and tried to kill her mother for the cash and the fancy hats he could afford her.
Great story. Oh, that was edge of the seat stuff, actually. I was just listening to all of that, like, what? Yeah, mother went to live with her in the end.
Indeed.
God, that's weird. And everything that she had done.
It's one of those things, because there is another account that the Inspector Guillaume Chappie, years later, he wrote his memoirs, years and years later. And he referenced this particular case in his writings. And he was known as a very shrewd judge of character. He knew people. And he actually suspected that what she had said about her father may have been true.
Mm.
And then, so it does potentially make you think, well, perhaps did the mother know it was true? And if she was happy to go and live with her daughter who had done this thing and quite happy, openly admitted to having done this thing. So there is something that weird there that might be.
Yeah, that, I mean, it is food for thought, isn't it?
Potentially possible. I mean, I don't know if we can say that it justifies murder.
No, I don't. Nothing justifies murder.
Nothing justifies that, but obviously.
But as we've always said, you know, nothing justifies murder. There's many schools of thought you can go down. The most obvious two are that if she was molested, if she had been molested by her father, she would be acting out. She would be being an absolute terror to her parents and going off and trying to forge her own ways in escaping their control or escaping her father's control. If that had all been going on, then killed them to take the money. That it explains some of the sociopathic, psychopathic behaviour if you've been subjected to that. There's also the other school of thought where she claimed
perhaps she was just a party girl and she just loved her life. Yeah. She wasn't ashamed of lying and getting what she needed to get the money to do what she wanted. She was having a great
possible
time.
Possible that she was just a petulant teenager who was going off and living the wild life and was just annoying their parents, and she made up lies and she made up whatever excuse it was. If she tried to kill them, the father story makes more sense. But if she was just trying to kill them repeatedly because she wanted the money and she wanted to go off and live with her boyfriends, I mean, it's horrible. It's really, really grim and dire.
I mean, even for whatever reason she did it, the calculation and the planning of the alibis and the, I'll do it on the Sunday, but I'll find them on the Monday and I've got my alibi set up. I mean, that requires some serious thinking and serious smarts to get that worked out.
If she's thought that through that methodically, and there has been evidence of stuff beforehand, and the rest of her life she goes off and lives apparently a blameless life, maybe, you know, people can repent, people can reform, but it does give a slight hint of a psychopath and a sociopath, really, if that's happening. It's an odd one, really.
It's a curious one. Sometimes you feel slightly sympathetic, and then sometimes you go, no, she's just nuts.
Well, everything that, all the evidence in that, aside from that allegation, was that she was nuts and that she was quite the bitch. I mean, the boyfriend and, you know, making the judgments earlier on saying like, oh, she went and did sex work, but he didn't. You know, maybe he had no idea. Maybe she was just off being a fancy woman and she was just getting cash off whoever was around. Maybe it wasn't a particular arrangement or anything, he didn't know. But yeah, she was waiting to get the cash off mummy and daddy because she wanted to live the high life and lives were expendable. God, it's weird. Ooh, creepy. And also to claim you're pregnant when you're not pregnant.
Oh yeah, well, you're very obviously not, and that can be easily tested and verified.
We could spend hours going over why the mother went to live with her daughter later on.
Well, indeed,
maybe they did forgive each other and she was reformed, and 20 years later she was like, yeah, mummy, come and live with me, look, I've got 5 kids, they're still alive, look, I've proven myself, I haven't killed any of them, it's fine. Oh, that is a good story. Feels like a film one as well. Oh, we need to adapt that. Let's write a script and write a play based around it. I love it. What do you think, guys? What do you think of this case? Do you think, you know, are you siding with crazy bitch? Are you siding with there was more going on here? Why else would she do stuff? Have you ever left the gas on accidentally and worried if you would be accused of poison? Because gas is horrible.
Have you ever set your bedroom curtains alight?
Send us your theories and your thoughts. And the Left Bank Martini, absolutely delicious. That broke the bad run, the mediocre run, I should say.
Definitely did.
Yeah, and that was most welcome because it was really lovely. That went down an absolute treat. It's another one that, yes, you may need to get some elderflower liqueur, but there's a lot of cocktails, as Nick has said, with elderflower in it. And also, you can use that for many, many things. Just put it in your water.
Right. It's an option. But the recipe will be out on Friday. So let us know what you think.
If you haven't already, come and join us over on Patreon, where there are loads of extra episodes, lots of extra free material, and you can come and have a chat with us and tell us what you'd like to hear from us on Patreon. We're doing a little survey at the moment. Check out our merch store if you haven't already. If you need some mugs, or if you need some stickers or some hoodies, if you're anything like me during lockdown, you're just buying shit for no reason. May as well buy some poisonous cabinet shit while you're doing it.
Absolutely.
It's very therapeutic. I highly recommend it.
Quite right, yes.
Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the poisonous cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.